And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any one of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight, I'm really excited about. He's a very dear friend of mine, and a lot of people here love him. And I just want to welcome him tonight. And with that, I give you Philip.
I'm Philip, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, I'm loud, brother. I'm going to back that thing up a little bit. It's only by the grace of God that I'm allowed to stand up here tonight without the desire to drink any liquor, pop any pills, or use any people. I do have other issues, but Frankie Rice told me a long time ago, this is AA, so I'll be sticking to my alcohol problems. Usually when I start, I got this poem, it's not dirty, that I like to say, I got this thing from a guy, he's a district speaker in Macon, he was in Macon speaking, but I had already heard his tape. I tell you how old I am, it was on a cassette. His name's Mo H, and I told him I was going to borrow it, and he said I could, and I could tell him where I got it. So that's where I got this poem, and it just kind of explains where alcohol took me. And it goes a little something like this. So it was a cold day in October, and I was far from being sober as I was carrying a load on with manly pride. My feet began to stutter, and I fell down in the gutter, and a pig come up and laid down by my side. We was talking of the weather as two good friends to get together when some ladies passing by was heard to say, you can tell of one who boozes by the company that he chooses, and the pig got up and slowly walked away. That's pretty much where I was. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'll give you a little background on myself. I was born in 1949. That makes me 63. I'm done. I was born in Greenwood, South Carolina. I have two older sisters, no brothers. I was the baby in the family, and believe me, I took advantage of that. My mom's... She passed away in 83. She was my best friend, and I thought that was the worst thing that could ever happen to me, but I was wrong. And I'll get to that in a little bit. I went to school. My dad studied ministry, and he was studying to be a Pentecostal pastor. So the first 8 years or so of my life, or maybe a little more, I'm not real clear, and I'll try not to jump around too much, but bear with me. We spent a lot of time in church, so I knew about this God, and today I have a different relationship with the God of my understanding, which is the same God, but we have this thing. I agree not to try to be him, and it works out fine for both of us. So, We moved to this place on the south side of town called Blair Village, and it was this rough kind of place. My dad worked all the time, so I was pretty much raised by my mom and my sisters and a couple of aunts and two grandmothers, and only one of the grandmothers wouldn't put up with none of my crap. But all the other women in my family spoiled me rotten, and it was never my fault. Which would come to haunt me later on in life. But at that time, I took full advantage of it. I learned a lot of things as a youngin. I learned how to manipulate. I learned how to lie. And I learned how to say I didn't do it. I wasn't admitting nothing. I didn't care if they caught me red-handed. I didn't do it. That's all it was to it. And my mom, bless her heart, if he said he didn't do it, he didn't do it. You know what I mean? So that would cause me some trouble. But I played a lot of sports when I was in school. Young, starting off with the little Pee Wee League. Like I said, my dad was gone a lot. He wasn't around a lot. Some coaches took interest in me, and on up through the years, you know, I got pretty good. And I had a dream at one time of being a professional baseball player, first baseman. And later on in life, alcohol would take that away. I drew a blank. That'll happen a couple more times probably. In school, I had a really hard time because I was ADD, ADHD, ABC, whatever they had a letter for. They said now that I had it then, but my therapist at the VA says if they had a poster boy for Ritalin back then, you would have been the guy. So it was slow to learn. I was slow to learn, and that caused me a lot of problems because I'd get bored. And, you know, I would just start fidgeting, and I, you know, if I couldn't learn something, I would cause problems in the class. I like to call myself, when I got on into high school, one of my friends said I was an outstanding student, always outstanding by the principal's office. And that was pretty much it because, like I said, I just stayed in trouble. But I managed to get through. And I think a couple of those teachers passed me just to get rid of me. My fifth grade teacher said I wouldn't amount to anything. So this is for her. So all the way as a kid, you know, I picked up on a lot of stuff. I was in and out of school, in and out of trouble. I never get into any lawman trouble until, you know, in my early teens, and then that started. When I got to high school, my sisters were already there. So I knew some of the older people, you know, that come to the house, and that's, I never did, you know, I always hung out with the older guys. Now I like to hang out with the younger people because I'm older. living vicariously. But I would, all the way through school, and when I got to high school, I figured out that if you was really good at sports, which I was really good at baseball and basketball. I played football a couple of years, but I really didn't like it, and I ran a little track, but I was really good at baseball. And I figured out if you could play sports really well and you got in trouble in school, the coaches, if you had to practice that day or a game or something, they would come and get you out of detention. And nobody said anything about it, and you didn't have to hold a certain grade average to play sports, which was a plus for me because, you know, like I said, I squeaked by. My sisters would work with me and try to help me out, but I wasn't interested in learning a lot. You know, my dad, and like I said, he was gone a lot. When he did come to my sporting events, he was kind of hot-headed. He jumped the fence, chased an umpire around one night because he thought he made a bad call. So I was kind of glad when he didn't show up, you know. I think I tasted my first alcohol. I was camping with some friends because, you know, back then you could go all the way out in the woods and run all over the place. As long as you was home by dark for dinner, you know, nobody messed with you back then. It was safe to do those kind of things, but... we were camping, and one of the guys had snuck a couple of beers, and I think I was about 13 or so, and I tasted it, and, you know, it wasn't no big deal for me. It just wasn't, and I didn't go out seeking it to drink then, but when I got old enough to drive and I got my driver's license, that changed everything. I quit playing sports, and I started hanging out with guys in school who liked to drink and fight and cuss and chase girls. You know, that's just the way it was. You know, I did that for a good while, and I think I lacked about a little over a year. And I went home one day, and I told my mom I was smart enough. I didn't need school anymore, so you need to come down here and sign me out. And, of course, here she comes. You know, they're picking on my baby. So let's get him out of there. And you know, this would cause me a lot of problems. But when I started driving and drinking, back then there was a lot of dirt roads around, you know, and the police didn't mess with you too much. We knew most of the police, and they would pull you over and they would pour your stuff out instead of locking you up unless you was doing something really bad. So all that kind of just edged me on to do more of it. And I remember when I did get drunk the first time, I was in a blackout. And I remember after that, I was able to drink, and it made me brave. It ended that fear, you know, because I always had a fear inside that I wasn't good enough or I didn't fit in. You know, and I always felt like that for some reason. So the alcohol, had to help me to fit in. And so through my teens, you know, after I quit school, I started to work, and I was dating this girl for a couple of years. And I think it was sometimes in 68, she called me and said, "Well, I'm pregnant." And back then, you know, that the thing to do back then was the shotgun wedding thing. You know, you had to get married, or that's what I thought. But I went to her granddad was a Baptist minister, and I went to the Baptist church in Hayfield where she was. It was a summer where she was out of school and she was working in the nursery. And I went over there to ask her to marry me, and her granddaddy chased me around the parking lot with a tire tube. He wouldn't have no part of it, and I was laughing. I was laughing so hard. I was running and laughing. Finally, we got everything calmed down, and nobody tried to kill me, and we got married, and that was the thing to do. And that's when my first little girl was born, Kimberly, my oldest daughter. And right after that, you know, I was working at the time. I was doing floor covering, actually, right here in this area from a place over here in Brookhaven called the Rug Market. And it was my dad and a friend of his from Rich's. It was their place. And I started off sweeping the floors. And then the installer came in one day and he said, "I need an apprentice. Do you want me to teach you how to do floor covering?" I said, "Sure, because it's a lot more money." So I got a raise and a promotion. And I worked and I went home and I drank on the weekends. I was more or less a weekend warrior. I would drink a little bit during the week. I had no idea how the progression was going to do. You know, and because of everything I learned when I was younger, as far as surrender goes, because the way I was raised by my dad and my uncles and the people in the neighborhood, you didn't surrender. You know, if you surrendered, you went from predator to prey really, really fast. You know, you'd rather get beat down than to say, "I quit." So, step one when I got to that in this program was really hard for me to accept that I couldn't handle this. But I just I jumped ahead a little bit. But I went through something. I don't know what it was, but I wanted to get away. So I told my dad I was going to join the Marine Corps and make a career out of it. Well, that didn't happen. I mean, I got in there and I did what I was supposed to do, and they used me up. And when I got through, you know, I just went on about my business. And that's all I'm going to say about the Marine Corps. You know, while I was in there, you know, we had visitations and all that. My wife got pregnant again. I had a son in 1970. And those were my two oldest kids by this woman. And when I came home, you know, I didn't know how to trust. That's the way I was raised. I didn't know how to trust women. I didn't know how to communicate. It was all about me, you know, and it was all about I didn't do it. So that relationship didn't last too long. I mean, long enough to have two kids, and then, you know, I was ready to do something else, and so was she. And that's just the way that happened. You know, I love my children at that point, and I hated because she had her own problems, and I knew what they were going through at the time. So I worked really hard, and I tried to keep up with what was going on with my kids because I knew sooner or later I had to get custody. I wanted custody of my two kids. And I stayed a single guy for the longest time, you know. And when I came, like I said, in the 70s when I had gotten out of the Marine Corps, they taught me how to fight. They taught me how to drink. And they taught me that, you know, respect your family and your friends. So if you was outside of that little group, I had sworn because of some of the drill instructors in there and the way they treated us that I wouldn't let anybody else put their hands on me, you know, that was pretty much over. So I had a lot of problems with violence and I had a lot of problems with the police because they had uniforms on, and every time they would stop me, I would get locked up, beat up, or somebody was going to get beat up every time they stopped me. And I'm not proud of none of this, y'all. I'm not bragging. This is just the way I lived. And all through the 70s, it was like that. And, you know, I worked a little bit when I came home, but I got involved with some friends of mine, I guess we'll just call it a South American import business. So I did that for quite a while. And I would work a little bit, too, because, see, I needed it to look like I was doing legal stuff. And I could fit in, you know. I could just fit in anywhere. And I was that guy during the week. You know, my day started about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. So, I was that guy. I was a dad when I needed to be. And I was that guy when I needed to be, or I could be just about whatever you needed me to be to fit in or to do whatever I had to do. And the drinking just kind of got worse, and it got worse. And as much as I would say I'm not going to do it, I would do it anyway. All the way through the 70s, doing what I was doing cost me a lot of money, cost me a lot of time in jail. I learned how to do other things, but I've never been able to walk away from the alcohol. I've never been able to put the alcohol down. Everything else I ever tried in my life, I could walk away from. Two things that would mess me up quicker than anything is cold beer and women. Not necessarily in that order either. I mean, that's just the way it was. So, I did what I had to do. Something happened that just changed everything in 1978. I got custody of my two kids. My ex was just having some horrible, horrible times. I was paying my child support religiously, and the money wasn't going to my kids. And, you know, I'm not going to talk bad about her. She just had her own problems at that time. And finally, after from like 72 to 78, of me trying to get my kids, and it was really hard for a dad to do that back then. She just called me one day and she said, "I can't handle these kids anymore." You know, so I found myself a single dad with two kids, and my mom. Thank God for my mom because she was alive at the time and she helped a lot. She babysat while I worked, and you know, if I needed to go somewhere, I would leave my kids with her. If I wanted to go out, because I was still doing my thing, you know, but I worked. I quit doing the other stuff I was doing. And actually, when I got custody of my kids, I moved to South Carolina for a couple of years, back where I was born in Greenwood. And I got a job up there floor covering, and then stayed up there almost 2 years, and I came home. And when I came home, I went straight back to Stewart Avenue. That's where I was born. That's where I was raised, not born. Might as well say born. That's where I learned how to do the things that I learned how to do, was Stewart and Cleveland. And if you knew anything about Stewart and Cleveland in the 70s, there was a bar we went to all the time. If you didn't have a gun or a knife, they'd give you one at the door. just so things would be fair. You know, I mean, it was really that bad. That's the kind of places I like to hang out, because those were my people. Those were the kind of people I liked, you know. People crazier than I was. But, you know, I kept my kids, you know, I stayed with them, I worked, and I did what I thought I was supposed to do, and I stayed single for the longest time, and then I think in 80-something, I can't remember all the dates, I met another good-looking woman, and there it went, you know, again. I have this problem with saying no to pretty girls. And I ended up married again and having my middle son. His name is Mason, and he has my problem today. I just went through some stuff with him, and I'm just praying for him. I learned something about things I can control and things I can't control due to this program and working these steps. And, you know, that didn't last either, because it was still all about me. I didn't know anything about AA or 12 steps or, you know, I didn't know anything. I didn't know how to communicate with women. Like I said, I would do what I wanted to do and you were supposed to like it. That's pretty much the way it was. But I knew how to smooth things over, see, because I learned that as a child. I learned how to smooth things over, so, you know, they would last a little bit longer than I expected them to sometimes, the relationships. I used to say I didn't know anything about relationships. I took hostages, and I turned them into victims. And that's pretty much the way it was. You know, so I ended up with three kids all of a sudden. And this lady, I come home from work. In 80, I got tired of doing what I was doing in the floor business. And so a friend of mine, he said, "Man, you like to talk. You run your mouth all the time. I'm running this car lot over here. How about come and let me train you how to sell cars?" I'm like, "I don't know nothing about cars." He said, "Yeah, but trust me. Just come and trust me and let me teach you." So that's what I started doing, and that's how I started making my living. And I loved it, actually. I didn't have to do any physical labor. I just had to outthink you and make you trust me so you would spend your money with me. And I learned how to do that very well. I came home. I was working with South Lake Ford at the time. It's Allen Vigil Ford now, in Jonesboro, and I was living in Riverdale, and I came home, and the second wife, had taken everything out of the house. I guess they backed the truck up, because I had a long day that day, you know, and she knew I'd be gone at least 12 hours, and I come in, there wasn't anything but my first two kids' furniture in their room, and my chair, and a table, and a lamp, and that was pretty much it. She took everything and went back to making. I don't blame her. I'd have left me earlier than that. But she went back to Macon, so here I am. I still got my two kids. Now I'm running back and forth to Macon on the weekends or every other weekend or however often to see my son. And that went on for a while. And like I mentioned earlier, in 1983, I think this was about the time she left, because my mom had gotten sick, and this woman never was sick. She had headaches, sinus headaches in the sinus time, but she got sick, and it was just like 2 months of them saying, you know, that they put her in the hospital, and 2 months later she died. And that just broke my heart, you know. I stayed drunk a lot. I worked a lot, but, I mean, I made sure I went to work, but sometimes I went to work, and I was still buzzing from the night before. And my manager would make me stand out in the heat or the cold and wouldn't let me wait on anybody. And so you're going to be the doorman today until you can come in without that kind of stuff going on. But I guess he understood. I don't know what I was going through. I know I stayed drunk the whole time my mom was in the hospital, and I didn't want to have to deal with it. And I watched them give her some horrible radiation that turned her into a totally different person. And then she passed on. And I moved out of the house in Riverdale with my two kids into the house with my dad right after that, because that was the only time I ever seen my dad drunk. And it's right after my mom passed away. He got a big old bottle of Crown, and he sat there and he drank until he passed out. And I drank some with him, and you know, we had family in and out, so there was a lot of drinking. There's a lot of drinking in my family, y'all. There's a lot of gathering. My family loves to gather and they love to drink. They're getting better about it now, though. You know, this was something that happened that I just was not ready for. So I met this other girl. Y'all know where I'm going with this. So, you know, and we got married, and we moved into a place down in Rex, Georgia, and I had another little baby. That's my youngest daughter, Samantha. Let's call her Sam. I call her Little Mickey. That was my mother's nickname was Mickey. That's what her brothers called her. So she's just like my mom. So I call her Little Mickey. But she's the light of my life. We've been through a lot together. She has her own demons. She battles anorexia. When I first started getting sober, she weighed 72 pounds. And she had been in and out of the hospital. And, you know, that whole time I was more concerned about getting drunk and doing what I did and I didn't see all that, you know. I didn't want to see it. You know, I didn't know it was as serious as it was. And, you know, I skipped ahead a little bit. After she was born, we moved to Macon so I could be close. This was after my oldest two kids graduated from Morrill High. And when they graduated, got them a little car, gave them a little money, pat them on the tail, and told them to get out of my house. So they did. They was ready anyway. They had their own life to live, and they was ready to do that, and it turned out really well. So we moved to Macon so I could be around my other son, my youngest son. And we bought a house out in the country, and I loved that house. I was sitting way back off the woods, and you know, man, I could just get drunk and run around the yard naked when the kids were asleep. You know, whatever I wanted to do down there, it was just wide open country down there, and I just loved it. And we stayed in that house for a while. I had a 15-year loan. I owed 7 years on it when I had to walk away from it because, once again, you know, as long as me and this lady stayed married, I took her for granted. I took our relationship for granted. I started doing the things because off and on through all this whole time, from the time I started drinking up until this time here, you know, I binged. I could get myself together. I don't know why God, because it was all God, allowed me to work and be like that, but he did, because I had to provide. And that's, you know, I was always a husband, a provider, and a dad, and then later on a granddad. And all of a sudden, and I was coming home one night in 1996, and I was just really, really sick. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I had just drank so much I was almost straight, you know, but I was sick. And I asked God, I said, God, I just don't care what you do, just slow me down. You know, this has got to stop. My marriage was on the rocks. It was fixing to be over. I could see the handwriting on the wall. I could see it coming, but I could not stop doing what I was doing. And I don't think I mentioned this, but in 86, before we moved to Macon, my boss and my wife got together, and that's the first time I ever had an intervention done on me. And my boss said, "You're going to treatment, or I'm going to fire you." And then she was like, "Well, you're going to treatment, or I'm going to leave." So I went to treatment, and I went to Charter out here. I guess it's Charter Peachford back then. It was in 1986. I did the 8 weeks over there. I went back to work, gained weight, I looked good. And that lasted for a little while. And I was going to meetings. The first AA meeting I walked into was in Clayton County, called the Clayton House. That's where I met Frankie Rice and a couple other people. that I still know to this day. Not Frankie, he's passed on. God rest his soul. But that's where I got the seed, you know. That messed up my drinking. I mean, every time I would start drinking after that, all this AA crap would be bouncing around in my head. I would hear people saying things that I didn't want to hear. All this stuff was going on up here, you know, and I was still trying to do what I wanted to do. So, like, when I got to Macon, you know, when we moved to Macon and all through that 80s and 90s, I would run in and out of the rooms, in and out of the rooms, because the first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and lives become unmanageable. I didn't know anything about the we part, you know. I think I used AA as a social club, and I would get myself straight, my head clear, and after a while, I would convince myself, I would tell myself that big lie, it'll be different this time, I can drink one. Never worked out like that. As many times as I tried to just drink one or to control drink, it never worked out like that. So I'm right in the middle of a divorce in 97. I get sick. Don't know what's going on. I lose a lot of weight. Going to the VA. And I had some pretty serious health problems and had to take some chemo. And I lost a bunch of weight. And I was just, you know, beside myself because at that time I had moved away from my home. And I gave it to my ex and my daughter because she was still in school and my son was still down there. And I just told her, you know, you just take the house. I'll leave. I don't want her to have to be uprooted from school. So I came back to Atlanta and went back to work for some friends of mine running a car lot. Well, actually running six car lots. It was called Otto Smith. He had bunch of lots around, buy here, pay here. He had his own finance company. My job was just to ride from lot to lot, checking inventory, making sure the salespeople were working right, making sure the down payments was right and all that stuff. And I started back drinking again and stuff. And I was, you know, pretty sick, but I would go to the doctor at the VA hungover and they would say, you know, you're just killing yourself. I said, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die my way. So that's the kind of mentality I had about the alcohol at that time, see, because I just lost another wife. I moved away from my daughter. And, you know, I was a mess. I was a wreck. Still able to go to work every day. Running in and out of AA, too. Every chance I got. You know, every time I got in trouble, every time I wanted to get the judge off my back or get the probation off my back or whatever, you know, I ran in and out. I didn't know anything about accepting the fact that I couldn't drink. I went to see my daughter one weekend in Macon, and she cried and said, Daddy, I want you to move back down here. You know, I don't get to see you enough because we spend a lot of time together. Her and my son both, they said, move back to Macon. So I did that. I just quit this job up here, and I called a friend of mine in Macon, had a car lot, and he put me to work the very next day. And I moved that weekend, and the Monday coming up, my daughter had to go to school. She was in middle school in a place in Gray, Georgia. And I took her to school, and I dropped her off. And I had been gone a few months, you know. And while I was gone, they popped this red light up on Gray Highway, right where Highway 18 deads in, if anybody knows that area. Never been a red light there for over 100 years. And I've been gone. I couldn't tell you if I went through that light or what happened that morning taking her to school because we were talking. And when I dropped her off and came back, I was going to work, sober, had been back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a sponsor, and was, you know, doing what I thought was the right thing. And I did not see that light. When I looked up, I saw it. It was too late. I hit my brakes. I slid through. It was a minor accident, about 35 miles an hour, something like that. I was not drinking. I didn't have any drugs or alcohol in my system. And I hit right at the back behind the driver on the passenger door in the back. And the little girl, 14-year-old girl, was sitting back there. She didn't have her seatbelt on. And a result, she hit her head, bounced around the back a couple of times, and 5 days later, she died in the hospital. Her brain swelled. I went to see her while she was in the hospital before the lawyers got involved, and I was arrested for vehicular homicide. And this was like a big political thing because they didn't have no warnings up for this light until the day after that young lady died, and then the DOT went and slapped up some rudders in the road and these big flashing lights, red light 1,000 foot and all this stuff, you know. So I was really upset with the DOT. I was upset with myself, and I got really pissed off at God.
How are we doing?
All right, I don't have much time. I got really pissed off at God, and I couldn't understand. I kept asking myself why. I made the decision to go back out. That's the only way I could handle this. The stage was set. I mean, I had a lot of people in Macon, in the fellowship, in the program that could help me. I had a lot of people in other places that could help me, but I couldn't help myself. So all of a sudden, I'm angry at God. I didn't trust God, and I went back out, and I stayed out 10 years, and that was, it was rough. And I didn't go out this time trying to control drink. I didn't have that in my mind. I just didn't care. I didn't want to feel. So I drank not to feel, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. Somehow or another, I ended up in Noonan, Georgia, where I was working for the guy that rented me the apartment. I had a little one-bedroom apartment, and he rented it to me, and I was taking care of his properties, and that allowed me, at that time, the VA had approved my claim, so I had money coming in from the VA, and I didn't have to work but a couple of days a week. And the last 5 years I was out was just pure hell. I could not, every time I got drunk, I would just get wasted. And I would leave the house sometimes in a blackout. And I would wake up in jail not knowing how I got there. Sometimes I'd wake up in Coweta County, but most of the time it was Spalding, where my daughter was staying at the time, and Clayton, where my other son was at. And I think out of that last 5 years I was out there, I spent probably two-thirds of that time in and out of county, one county jail or the other. One night in my apartment in Noonan, I just threw my hands up and I said, "My God, I cannot do this anymore." I called on the very God that I was so pissed at that I said I would never trust again. I had beat myself down. I had self-inflicted myself so bad. I was just in self-inflicted misery. I mean, it was horrible. And I called on the very God I said I wouldn't call on. And the only time I called on Him during those whole 10 years was when that metal door would slam behind me, and I was aware I was there. And then I'd turn into Billy Graham. I was going to save everybody. Couldn't save myself, though. It was just... I don't know what. I didn't see no light. I didn't see no burning bush. But I knew something was different. Because I told God, I said, "Look, I'm not going to make no deals with you like I did when I was in jail and break them." Because every time I'd make a deal and they open that door, I'd go get drunk again. I just said, "Look, just change me. You know, help me change in the morning. Give me a different outlook or kill me tonight when I do lay down, because I just don't want to live like this anymore." So, by the grace of God, I was sent back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized that if I was going to stay sober, this was the only place that I could come. I knew I had enough of AA in me to know that everything that I was doing wasn't good, wasn't working. Nothing I could do to stop myself would work. Nothing my family could do, which deserted me, and they should have. My sisters wouldn't talk to me the last 4 years I was out. You know, my daughter would come by every couple of weeks just to make sure I had food. You know, it was just, I had gotten to that point, like where the pig was, you know, how the pig in the gutter with the guy with the pig. And nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. And for some reason, when I came back in the room the very first day, my head was still jumbled up. I had a wet brain. You know, it took me 8 or 9 months to get cleared up enough to pick a sponsor. But I knew, I realized then that I was in the right place. I realized that if I was going to have a shot at staying sober, I needed to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew enough about it to know that to see the hope in the rooms, to know the people set here before me, all the years before me, that it was working for them, and they're still coming and they're still showing up. Because see, that was one of my big things, running in and out of the meetings. I would stop going to meetings. I'd get 8 or 9 months and I'd stop going to meetings. I'd stop calling my sponsor. I'd stop doing everything, and I'd end up drunk again. And this time around, when I cried out and when I got back in these rooms, God gave me the gift of desperation. I've heard that said in here so many times. And with that came a willingness to do whatever it took. That's all I cared about. I didn't come in here to be spiritual. I didn't come in here for any other reason other than to not drink for one day, because I didn't know how to do that. I did not know how to do that. So I had this willingness, you know, that honesty, that open-minded, that willingness to find out what was going on and just to get through a day without drinking. And my sobriety date is April the 12th, 2008. I'm coming up on 5 years, if God's willing, because I am today. Something clicked. This is the only program I know of that you have to quit to win. You have to admit defeat to have victory. I mean, it's just, I never saw the things before that I saw this time around. You know, when I finally did get a sponsor, we started working the steps, and step three was really hard for me to get through because of the trust issue. And that came a little bit at the time, and I got better with that, and I'm better with that today. I have a really good working relationship with God, of my understanding today, and when my family all came back, everything started coming back to me. When I started doing the right thing and just taking care of Philip, things started coming back. Things started coming back to me, my family and friends and everything. And I just buried my dad a few weeks ago. He was 88 years old. He had a great life. I think he was ready to go, because when I saw him, I think he just had, you know, given up. I wouldn't have been able to be there for that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have been drunk somewhere. If the family had even let me known, I probably would have had some excuse not to show up. Because of the working the 12 steps of this program, I was able to be in the room in a little town in Georgia. I think it's Vienna or Viwina or something like that. I don't know. And I got to see my two great-granddaughters born, you know, due to working these steps and doing whatever it takes to not drink for one day. And I'm still there. I hope I never forget that I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. I cannot drink one drink. I work with my sponsor. I clean my house. You know, I got rid of all this crap in here so I could put some good stuff in. And, you know, today I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my life to people like y'all sitting around the room. I don't know why God sent me to NABA. You know, I was pretty happy on my side of town. You know, I was pretty happy. I knew things was changing because I wasn't chasing women in the rooms. You know, that was a plus. But I'm gonna hug you. I'm gonna tell you right now. You know, God has just blessed me so much because of this program and this fellowship. I work the steps. I work with sponsees today. We work the steps together, and it's just amazing. Sometimes I can be in my apartment and something go wrong, and I'm all up in my head, nah, nah, you know, and just got all this stuff going on up here, and the phone can ring and be one of my sponsees with a worse problem. And talking to him, I realized when I hang up that my problem just left me, you know, because I was helping him deal with his. And isn't that how this program works? Pay it forward. I know we're just about out of time, so I got something I'm going to read. I don't never do this, y'all. But I was sitting on the couch today, and I don't know why, but something just moved me to get and pick up my favorite book, y'all, As Bill Sees It. And this has to do with fear, and it's on page 51. It's called The Coming of Faith. In my own case, the foundation stone of freedom from fear is that of faith, a faith that, despite all worldly appearances to the contrary, causes me to believe that I live in a universe that makes sense. To me, this means a belief in a creator who is all power, justice, and love, a God who intends for me a purpose, a meaning, and a destiny to grow. However, little and haltingly, toward his own likeness and image. Before the coming of faith, I had lived as an alien in a cosmos that too often seemed both hostile and cruel. Before the coming of faith, I had lived as an alien in a cosmos that too often seemed both hostile and cruel. I said that again. In it, there could be no inner security for me. When I was driven to my knees by alcohol, this is exactly what happened. I was made ready to ask for the gift of faith. And all was changed. Never again, my pains and my problems notwithstanding, would I experience my former desolation. I saw the universe to be lighted by God's love, and I was alone no more. And I would never want to say or do anything that would cause anybody not want to do this for themselves. It's just awesome. So I appreciate y'all coming and listening.
Thank you, Phila. That was awesome. Really appreciate your service work.
But it's been walked before. to that hill, gone flat and down. I won't have to fight it no more. Somehow, some way, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.